what's funny is the just raw misconceptions of the Constitution. So if we look at the First Amendment, what is more referenced when you grow up than the First Amendment?
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. But what's funny is the First Amendment doesn't guarantee you any rights. What it does is tells Congress what it can't do.
Hello and welcome back to the Buck Starts Here, Buck Wild Edition. Co-host Eric Mason and I are currently between eras and frantically searching for topics to delay our entry into season two. So to avoid talking about Jackson for at least one or two more weeks, today we are going to be doing a deep dive into the Bill of Rights. When I pitched this to you, Eric, my hope is that we'd be looking through these, looking at these through the lenses of the Founding Fathers, so we can really try to get like an understanding of kind of the meaning behind the words. Like, what were they thinking when they wrote some of these things down? So I don't know, like, how do you want to handle this? Like, where do you want to start?
I take your directions to heart. So what I did during the research process of this is I said, I don't want to look at the, but it's funny when you research the Bill of Rights, a lot of times when you come up with this modern interpretations, what does the Fourth Amendment mean today? Right. But it was actually really fun to look at and say, no, we're not going to, and we can do a future episode talking about how the Bill of Rights have evolved over time, but instead taking a look at the Bill of Rights by the how it was thought of when it was written, right? And what's funny is the Bill of Rights is really a byproduct of the dialogue between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. So you have Federalists who wrote the Federalist Papers, the John Jays, Alexander Hamiltons, and so forth, who, you know, really, really pushed for the federal style of government that we have today. And then you have the Anti-Federalists. Now, sometimes there's a misnomer that these Anti-Federalists were anti-national government. And they weren't. They were about restricting the national government so you didn't end up having what happened with England.
So it wasn't so much that no federal government. They just wanted a weak federal government.
Yes. And what the Bill of Rights represents is kind of a document of consensus. There is, well, we talk about the Bill of Rights today, and there's some stuff that's controversial, and there's some stuff that people like, and there's different ways to interpret it. The Bill of Rights is actually a combination of amendments that kind of everybody agreed on at the time. How different is that than how we view the first 10 amendments today?
Right. We look at them as kind of like being linked with the Constitution, or at least that's the way I've always looked at it. But like, how long was the gap between the Constitution and the Bill of Rights?
It was about 3 years.
Like, we can start there. Yeah, that's a pretty significant period of time.
Yep. So the Bill of Rights didn't get passed until December. So I'd like the rest of the amendments to the U.S. Constitution, all 10 amendments to the Bill of Rights were passed at once. And not to tease a future discussion during here, there wasn't 10. There was actually 12.
Mm.
But 11 of them passed, but only 10 in 1791. Oh. The foreshadowing. That's right. Kyle, we're getting good at this. Well, I'm getting there. I'm getting better at this. You're already good at it.
We're learning.
Learning.
So, right.
So the U.S. Constitution operated for 3 years without a Bill of Rights, which that sounds crazy.
Well, it was funny because I was kind of looking through the Constitution as I was doing a little bit of preparing. This is the interlude. I don't think the standard rules apply. I get to look through the Constitution a little bit and see.
Standard rules. Like, okay.
I was trying to look to see like what set aside like the individual rights for the people. And like there wasn't a whole lot in the Constitution that sets that aside.
We're going to get into that in the second episode of this series, but to foreshadow a little bit of that is the Founding Fathers did not believe rights came from the government.
Mm-hmm.
So the Constitution takes rights. It does not give you any rights. This is a John Locke heavily influenced the U.S. Constitution. It's this idea of natural philosophy. So it's actually most of the Founding Fathers, the vast majority of them, viewed you are born with every single right you have, and you give up some of those rights for security. So the Constitution wouldn't give you any rights because you already have all your rights. And again, how bizarre is that compared to how we view the Constitution and even laws today?
Yeah. I kind of like the way that is kind of set aside because really that is what we do. Anytime we trade in for security, we're always trading in some freedoms of some sort.
Yeah. Benjamin Franklin, what's a famous Franklin quote? Anybody who's willing to sacrifice freedom for security deserves neither.
Where's my towel?
Where's my towel? Yes. John, open the window. Actual Ben Franklin quote to President Adams.
Had to have been somewhere, right?
Yeah. Oh, when they shared a bed when they were traveling, and they had to argue over which window was open. But no, and what's funny is the just raw misconceptions of the Constitution. So if we look at the First Amendment, what is more referenced when you grow up than the First Amendment?
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. But what's funny is the First Amendment doesn't guarantee you any rights. What it does is it tells Congress what it can't do. So to quote the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. I can't wait to look to see if the word peacefully didn't exist back then, because they used peaceably.
Huh. Peace. What did it say? Peaceably?
Yeah. Like the ability to be peace.
Right. That's bizarre.
Now, what's funny is there's a few things in there, right? The first thing addressed in the amendments is the law respecting the establishment of religion. Establishment of religion usually is seen to refer to Anglicanism in England, where the government basically said Henry VIII said everybody has to be Anglican.
Right.
Now, one of the counter things, and I remember being in college and having an English teacher bring this up one time and said, like, you know, there's a separation of church and state in the First Amendment. And it's like, well, no, that actually comes from a letter in 1808 in the Danbury Baptist Church. We didn't actually see this pop up until about 17 years later. And it was a letter that Jefferson wrote about it. So that's one of the biggest misconceptions about the First Amendment. The second is that you are protected in speech from anybody. Nope. It just says Congress cannot inhibit your ability to freedom of speech.
Right. And it doesn't say that you have freedom of speech either, right? Yeah.
It's just saying Congress will not reduce that. And we have seen cases of Congress doing that, though.
Like, when we talked about Mr. Adams, we talked about the Alien Seditions Acts. Like, how did those get passed then?
Yeah.
I guess they didn't hold up for very long. But.
Yeah, it's just, exactly. It's I'm often wondering what happened if that was, like, you know, that's hard to challenge in court. And I mean, don't forget, the only part of the Alien Sedition Acts that existed for any, you know, any amount of time was really the foreign agents. I mean, the Sedition Act was dead very, very quickly. I mean, never had a chance to be challenged. Also, it was before judicial review. So it's before the Supreme Court had the authority to rule things constitutional or unconstitutional. I have a feeling that would have been ruled unconstitutional virtually immediately.
Yeah, right.
But I think one of the interesting parts, and, you know, this comes to the discussion that affects all our lives, is the discussion of, like, misinformation, regardless of what the misinformation is used for, or what side of the aisle it's on. Other countries don't have a freedom of speech requirement. So their parliaments can make laws that abridge the freedom of speech, but we don't in the U.S. So it's kind of like this: with freedom naturally comes variability and naturally comes disorder. And it's, well, how much are you willing to trade? And the founding fathers at this time, there wasn't this idea of, like, oh, people, nobody would ever lie. Sometimes when you talk to people and you read the stuff, this idea, like, the founding fathers were like, oh, they would never lie to each other. Nobody would ever make anything up. These were honorable men. They were, but they also, you know, called each other hermaphroditical of character. They would absolutely make stuff up. I mean,
yes, they would.
They did all the time. So yeah, no, but that was seen as a trade-off, that we are going to lose some of that security, but it's always, but they viewed it as a necessary sacrifice to ensure that the people would be free to speak. Now, what's funny to remember is that during all this, there's only really one man adding and subtracting stuff from the Bill of Rights, and that's James Madison.
Jefferson wrote the Constitution, right? Mostly.
Madison wrote the Constitution.
Madison wrote it.
Jefferson wrote Declaration of Independence.
Okay. All right. I was curious if Madison felt, was he, like, upset or feeling, like, critiqued that these other 10 amendments were needed for, like, this work of art that he had put together?
No, dude, Madison was crazy, dude. Like, I think James Madison's, I think there's many cool parts of James Madison. He changed his opinion on stuff. He would get arguments from, like, Federalists and Anti-Federalists, and he just kept going back and forth. Oh, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe that's not a bad idea.
Do you imagine the feather in your cap, like, changing Madison's mind would have been?
Yeah, you're just like,
Yeah, just going to write that one down for re-election propaganda.
I'll put it this way. What's really cool is that James Madison was a Federalist. He wrote the Federalist Papers with John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. And mm-hmm. he also wrote the but he also drafted up the Bill of Rights, which is this big, I would argue, I think some people would argue.
That's pretty anti-Federalist, I would say.
Pretty anti-Federalist. And he right. was like, oh, this is cool. But people were coming back to him and saying, hey, you forgot this, specifically the Seventh Amendment. They said, hey, you mm-hmm. forgot to include this in here. And Madison's like, you're right. Let me get that in there. That wasn't in the original Constitution. Let's add to the Bill of Rights. So, like, America greatly benefited from James Madison, arguably one of the smartest human beings on the face of the earth at the time, being open to being corrected or being open to be added on. But
they could have had a complex.
Yeah. Or
lacked humility, but I'd probably been growing up slight and sickly, probably humbled him a little bit.
But what's funny is the First Amendment, it's real target. So it's been referred to over its life as the bulwarks of democracy. Is that this idea that if you can engage in free dialogue and you mm-hmm. can practice your faith freely and you have the ability to access to the press and this ability to peacefully assemble and all petition your government, that is really the foundation of what allows a democratic republic to operate, this idea of free-flowing information without worrying about being abridged by the government. And it traces its history back much to a myriad of different things. I don't want to reductionist right. argument. But two things that were very influential was the 1689 English Bill of Rights, but it was very, very heavily influenced by the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was written in 1776 by George Mason. And it really is very closely tied to those documents. Now, those documents, specifically the Virginia Declaration of Rights, had a lot more exposition, kind of explaining why, where the Bill of Rights does not explain itself. It says mm-hmm. these are the rights, but when you dive deeper to each amendment, there's a body of evidence, a body of discussion there. But kind of like one more last thing to hit on the First Amendment is that in its whole entirety, it was really there to stop governmental censorship. Like, that was its number right. one thing, is to say the government can't censor you, whether through stopping you from petitioning the government, stopping you from protesting, stopping you from being able to practice your faith, or because that's where people talked a lot, right? Like, that's where a lot of ideas were shared. And above all else, stopping you from being able to speak as you please. So it was really this idea of, like, we're going to stop governmental censorship. And that's really what the First Amendment is.
We've talked a lot about this. I don't know if it was on this program or previous things that we've done, other collaborations through the other programs that we do. But the last line on there, the ability to petition the government for redress of grievances, that's the thing that you've mentioned specifically highlighting what makes us different from every other country, is the fact that we talk about the things that we screwed up in our past.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it traces all back down to right here, this last little line right here. I mean, that's what gives us the ability to go and seek compensation for some of the things that the government's done in the past that it shouldn't have, right?
Yep, absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest flaws when people critique the United States. Mm-hmm. Every country is doing this.
Yeah. We just talk about it.
We just talk about it. Yeah. Do you want to live in, I mean, this is where the Bill of Rights, you can really see the founders have impressed themselves permanently on the U.S. population. It's this idea that, like, no, the people are where the authority for governance come from. And mm-hmm. this idea of natural law, that you were born with all your rights, that you then give some of those rights to the government, is permeated through the first six presidents very, very, very clearly. And we'll get on there because, listen, are we putting off doing the Jackson episodes because Eric's going to end up with high blood pressure? Of course, that's why we're doing it. I'm going to sacrifice high blood pressure in order to talk about Andrew Jackson. But we see a nonstop centralization of power from Andrew Jackson to Nixon. Mm-hmm. We are literally about to venture off an 140-year journey of continuous concentration of power in the executive branch that will start with Jackson and it will end with the War Power Acts. And mm-hmm. it's going to get weird. We're going to get real. If you just take the first six presidents, the people who existed and thought about government in the way of this natural philosophy and why the First Amendment is so important, and then you're going to have the stark comparison of Jackson, and you're going to be like, well, what?
Is this the same country?
It is. And then you're going to go through Buchanan, and you're Jackson to Buchanan is a wild mm-hmm. ride, because you're like, you went from like this near totalitarian system to what if we had a totalitarian guy who also was just completely incompetent which is right. the canon. It's like, oh, well, you end up with Civil War. We're so lucky Abraham Lincoln got elected. Like, we are unbelievably lucky that, like, the most competent person got elected, because without him, like, we're hosed.
You saying Jefferson Davis might have had a chance of being more than just an insurance salesman?
I was yelling about that today with somebody. I was like, dude, imagine buying your homeowner's insurance in the 1870s. It's like, what'd you do before? It's like, I tried to explore my own country. How'd that go? We got our teeth kicked in.
I'm selling you insurance. How do you think it went?
Yeah, how do you think it went?
More on anything more to say on this first one here?
Oh, I think we can go for the amendments for First Amendment for years. No, I was going
to
check.
Saying I need to censure you? Is that what's going on? Doesn't say anything about me censoring you.
No, it doesn't. You are not Congress, Kyle. You could censor me.
Mute. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, the show's ratings just went through the roof after you muted it.
Well, I think it's pretty easy to see what they were thinking, why they needed the Second Amendment, right?
Yeah. So the Second Amendment, to start off reading it, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I don't think I'm being, Kyle, yell at me for this. I don't think I'm being obtuse to say this is the most controversial amendment today.
I don't think you're.
And we're
saying it's not harboring quartering soldiers in time of peace in your home? You don't think it's that one?
Those two are tied together. They're the same. They're really the same amendment, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah. So. First off, the idea, and we're going to talk about this in the context of 1791. We're not going to talk about this in the context of today, right? Basically, everybody, we talked about this under all the previous presidents, is that there was this fear of standing armies. And the U.S. did not like the idea of standing armies. And so one of the ways to see, like, oh, how do you elevate people so that you either don't need a standing army, or if there is a standing army, they can counter them. It was not lost on the founding fathers or the American people at the time that the war kicked off with Minutemen, that it was armed citizens stopping the raiding of military material in Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts. Like, that is instilled in their mind. But what I think is more interesting is that as we were exploring this, because I said, very specifically when Kyle and I talked about this, is that we did not want to look forward on this because it becomes instantly political, and we're just not a political show. Like,
no,
we don't. Do Kyle and I discuss politics off camera? Of course you do. So why Kyle doesn't like talking to me any much.
I just don't want to pull out my hair on camera.
Yes. But when Kyle gave me the marching papers here, and he said, okay, I want to do one on the Bill of Rights. And just peek behind the curtain. When Kyle brought this up, like, was it a week ago, 2 weeks ago?
It was like 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, we skipped a recording session so I could just keep trying to dig deep on the research on this. Like, we try to do this quick, but we're trying to do it good. But Kyle, I was interested in this. I said, where did the Second Amendment come from? And I said, you know, you hear people saying, oh, the militia book, you say here this and that, blah, 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 and all that stuff.
Wasn't that part of the Massachusetts?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's Article 17. It was written. It was written in 1780, and it's very close in wording, almost verbatim. So to read Article 17 of the Massachusetts Constitution, the oldest still in use constitution in the world, the people have a right to keep and bear arms for the common defense, and as in time of peace, armies are dangerous to liberty, they ought not to be maintained without the consent of the legislator, and the military power shall always be held in an exact subordination to the civil authority and be governed by it. One of the interesting parts about the Second Amendment that doesn't get talked about, it is where we have the basis for the established civilian control of the military.
It doesn't really have the same verbiage like that, though, as the Massachusetts one does. Why did they drop that?
A lot of the articles that were used to make the amendment. So the amendments didn't come from nowhere. What they really came from is the English Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, a lot of writings of John Locke and the other philosophers, William Blackstone too, who's an English jurist. And they took these much more wordy amendments and articles from different state constitutions, and Madison absorbed that into the into the U.S. Constitution, but a lot of the committees involved adopted much slimmer language. They did that to make a more usable document for interpretation. They knew the Constitution was a living document, and they wanted to make sure that they wouldn't be so verbiose that people would lose meaning on here. I think one of the things that often surprised people when you read the Bill of Rights is really how few words are in the most prominent amendments.
I was thinking the same thing, but about the Constitution itself. Like, for something that sets up like the way our entire system of government works, it's surprisingly tight. Like, you're talking about like what, 3 pages? I get most of that stuff down on. Like, it's incredible, actually.
And it shows that effective, and that's from a national standpoint, it's one of the oldest still in use constitutions. I believe it is the oldest still in use national constitution. It was done on purpose because they wanted to, it's common law. They wanted to leave interpretations so those things could evolve. And they did it right. I mean, we are the third largest country on earth. We have the largest GDP. We have the most advanced tech. We have the most advanced military. Like, if you're a government and your government's like, what's the role of government, right? Prosperity and defense. Like, you did it. You did it. Congratulations. You wrote a document 250 years ago that somehow today is still something that provides for, you know, a level of economic productivity that's almost unimaginable, and an incredibly safe, safe nation from ability to defend itself, combined with, Kyle, do you know what the most trusted department in the federal government is by a huge margin?
It's probably Department of the Navy, I would guess.
No?
Oh.
It is the U.S. military. People have immense faith in the U.S. military that it's not going to become, you know, like it's not going to be used for a palace coup or something like that because people trust in the system. Like, you don't have that in the rest of the world. Like,
I mean, when I took my oath, it was to support and defend the Constitution. It was not to support and defend any sort of government. It was strictly the rights of the people. That was it.
But this idea of this well-regulated militia has probably caused more controversy in U.S. history than any other amendment. It was universally uncontroversial at the time. It was just...
Yeah. It came in handy. You kind of needed it.
Specifically where you could reference it and why it ties... All the amendments tie together. So... Mm-hmm. The Second Amendment is literally a bridge between the First and Third Amendment. So in the English Bill of Rights of 1689, which we referenced earlier, it declared that Protestant subjects could have arms for their defense as allowed by law. And like, that's kind of picking winners and losers in the enshrinement of religion.
Right.
And that's also, as you'll see, is that it will go towards the stability of having to quarter soldiers and disarm the citizenry. You know, in both the Federalists and Anti-Federalists both really distrusted a standing army. And they liked the idea of the citizen soldier being able to raise militias. And when we started seeing early constitutions, like the Pennsylvania Constitution, which is argument to be made as the first constitution of all the states, I would say it is. I'm like dead serious in the comments. I bet people could say, disagree with me. I know historians kind of go back and forth that was the first constitution. A lot of these early constitutions were declarations of rights. Massachusetts is like one of the last constitutions drafted, and that's like a straight up what you consider a constitution. A declaration of rights is a little different. But it enshrined this idea. The founders wanted to enshrine this idea. And this actually comes from the Virginia's Ratifying Convention of 1788. They were the ones that used that term, that people have the right to keep and bear arms, even in peacetime, is this idea that you have the right to self-defense. That is really what it comes down to. And how that's been, again, not what we discuss here, but how that's evolved over time. And I think it's important that as we talk about the Second Amendment's evolution over time, we start with what were the founding fathers thinking when they put it together. And they were thinking of, they don't like standing armies. They like the idea of a militia to counteract the government, combined with the idea that everybody has a right to self-defense. So a lot of times you'll see Kyle and I, we're political junkies. We read stuff. Like, we're not aloof to it.
Right.
You'll see the Second Amendment sometimes get reduced down to it was meant for X. And what I just want to Kyle, not speak for you, but what we just want to get across on here is that it's much more
nuanced than that. Yeah.
Several different things.
Yeah. It's the thing that allows us to have the first one. It's the one that protects the first one. It's the thing that allows keeps the government in check. It's like the final it's the final stop, right? It's the
if that, all that's anything how the body else goes,
this is the last thing we can do to go back and take power and stop things from progressing in a way we do not want.
Yeah, it's I think one of the interesting parts of the Second Amendment is that today, you know, as we consider it the super controversial thing, is that every state had that language in its constitution. Like, mm-hmm. It was almost as if it wasn't included in the original constitution because everybody just kind of assumed.
Oh.
So I was like, what do you mean we need to say this?
Maybe we'll just put this in because everybody else has it, so we'll stop everybody from having to say it too. Maybe that was kind of the mentality of it.
That really flows into the Third Amendment, this quartering mm-hmm. of soldiers, which Kyle and I in the pre-show, as we were ranting, I said to Kyle, I go, the most successful amendment of all time? Third Amendment.
Number three. That's crazy. And I was thinking about this. I mean, like, let's put yourself in the mind of somebody who just got done living through the Revolutionary War. You probably had to quarter some soldiers, and probably from both sides. Like, just the things that these people probably went through. And this is just the common soldiers, let alone if you had an officer in there. And you know the way that the officers were treated compared to common citizenry, at least on the English side. You had an officer taking over your house. Like, it was their house now. Like, you're done, right?
So all the amendments have been heavily adjudicated at the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Except this one. There is no line of Supreme Court cases on the Third Amendment. Occasionally, lower courts would they would try and use the Third Amendment to discuss stuff. Like, just for an example, there was Engblom versus Kerry in 1982, and it was because National Guard troops were temporarily housed in a correctional officer's residence.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, and if there's an attorney listening to me, like, totally comment on it, like.
Right.
Like, talk crap to me. Kyle will read it off to me later, and I'll be like, yeah, you're right. You're an attorney. But what I understood is that they were basically saying, like, because the National Guard were soldiers and they were staying on a residency, that violated the Third Amendment, and the Supreme Court, like, was like, no. they're just like, but there's one really cool one. Kyle,
has it ever come up? I mean, you brought up this one case, but I mean, does it never come up because the U.S. has never been in the habit of trying to quarter troops in civilians' homes because of our history with it? Or
yeah, I mean, if you think of it, the only time we've had border skirmish, the only time we've had war, right? 1812, right?
And what was the one with Spanish-American?
Spanish-American. Largely, you could argue that the War of 1812, that could have been fought in population centers, but the Mexican-American War and the Spanish-American War is later, but you could argue Mexican-American War was fought on a pretty open plain.
I would think that would be where it'd be more likely to happen, because then you're talking about very few places where you can quarter somebody, right. So you're going to go grab a ranch or a barn or something. And
yeah, I think they would just camp out in the fields, as right. opposed to during the American Revolution, they were literally putting soldiers inside people's homes and being told you have right. to feed them.
Yeah. Was that on our side or just the British side?
No, that was on the British side. They were putting British soldiers in homes, which is wild. But this is why the Constitution is so interesting. Mm-hmm. The Third Amendment has been brought up on one of the most interesting examples. There's a 1965 Supreme Court case. Now, the Supreme Court will often reference amendments, the Bill of Rights specifically, and they won't necessarily use them as a basis of ruling, but reference assumptions made within those amendments, or basically saying, if amendment means X, there is Y logical assumption. So in 1965, there was a Supreme Court case, Connecticut versus Griswold, which recognized a constitutional right to privacy in marital relations, because the court cited the Third Amendment as one of the evidences that there exists a zone of privacy, since forcibly quartering soldiers would violate the sanctity of a home, which really
meant there's an expectation of privacy in the home because of that.
Yes, and that the Third Amendment guarantees
fascinating.
That.
Really?
Isn't that awesome? Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, the Third Amendment is one of those that maybe you forget on trivia night what it is. It's a very important amendment that everybody agrees on. The least controversial thing in the Constitution.
All right, so what follows that one then?
So we go into every let's say freshman in college who's studying political sciences.
Do you have a warrant?
Do you have a warrant?
Yeah.
which there's like 27, there's like a 26 or 27 exceptions to like needing a warrant, by the way. Like, right. It's like you have to go to law school. Like law school is hard and attorneys are paid well because it's a difficult thing to do. It's complicated. Right. Like, I want to note, I do really want to note that to everybody listening, Kyle and I are not weighing legal opinions on constitutional law. This is literally just historical research and trying to frame it. So we have the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Shall not be violated. Wait, somebody?
Why would this be the one they reference when they're talking about the sanctity of your home or expectation of privacy?
I was literally about to say that clause. Look at you! The right of the so the Fourth Amendment is the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated and no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
So they can only search for what they expect to find. If they go in there with something, if it's not on their list and they find it, too bad.
Too bad. And this, so it's funny. If you bring this up, people, the number one court case we bring up is Ohio versus Matt. That was a very famous Supreme Court case in the 60s where basically this gentleman, Matt, was, his house got searched and he asked to see the search warrant. And I think the officer wouldn't show it to him or the officer like ripped it up or ate it or something like that, but just basically destroyed it. And that's the one that's referenced because it was like, well, you need to see the warrant. You don't have a right to, you know, that is a constitutionally protected act, right. Act as a warrant. So, but what it really comes down to is there's this case, Intick versus Carrington in 1765. So it's not 200 years before I was first mapped, because the Brits decided to start issuing general warrants.
Huh.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yep.
Pissed me off too.
They were just like, you can search whatever you want. But what's funny is that if you look at common law, and this is a lot of historians will point this out, that common law never allows for that. It hasn't allowed for that in hundreds of years before that. There's this idea as every man's house is his castle. That's like this concept was there. This is just not allowed. They're doing this specific to the colonies. So we talk about more broad picture of these general warrants. Kind of over time, how the Brits were treating the colonists, right, in the United States, is around in the 1760s, the British government started authorizing these called like writs of assistance, where like sometimes people refer to them as like blank check search warrants, where customs officers, specifically the customs officers, could search a colonist's home, business, and any personal effects they had for evidence of smuggled goods without specific cause or evidence. So just your existence and having goods could get you searched. In 1761, there was this very prominent attorney at the time named James Otis, who argued passionately against the writs, calling them instruments of slavery, and proclaiming that even tax collectors with a writ could enter all houses at will. And it really made every man's home insecure. And what I think is really funny is he goes on this passionate speech about English liberty. And, you know, that English liberty really begins at one's home. And he lost. He lost his argument.
Really?
But there was somebody sitting in the stands watching it. And like something out of a movie, it was John Adams. And John Adams referred to it as one of the most passionate defenses of liberties that he's ever seen. And he said that is the moment the revolution began, was in that courtroom.
Really?
Yeah. He said, once you start threatening the idea of home and self, he goes, that's when revolution starts. Not at Lexington and Concord, but in a courtroom.
Right.
Like, oh, John Adams?
John Adams again. John Adams. All right. Man, that feels like the note we should be ending on. You got a whole other amendment we got to get through.
Yeah, we can literally end on that. I'm fine. I can work that around.
No. We can get through one more, I think, here.
So, one more than a forgotten amendment.
That's really good. Okay, so we're coming up to one of my favorite ones is the Fifth.
The Fifth Amendment. As I said, the Fourth Amendment's every freshman studying political science's favorite.
This is every stoner amendment. Who watched Dave Chappelle. loves this one.
I was going to say junior studying political science, okay. But I like yours a lot better this time. But,
so, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So the Fifth Amendment really is a combination of a bunch of different legal documents, whether it's the English Bill of Rights, whether it's the Declaration of Rights from Virginia. The Magna Carta, Chapter 39 of the Magna Carta, basically proclaimed that no free man could be punished except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. And that phrasing is actually where a lot of legal scholars say the term due process of law comes from. I think it's kind of cool. It's not... Everybody's like, I plead the fifth. Pleading the fifth actually is like this broad spectrum of stuff. So the Fifth Amendment is your right to due process. You do not have to self-incriminate. That's the right to remain silent. No double jeopardy in the right to a grand jury. And here's a big one here. Takings. That's just something that never gets talked about here. But the rule of just compensation for taking property. Eminent domain is part of the Fifth Amendment.
Oh, wow. So you said this one never gained much popularity?
This is considered the Fifth Amendment is generally considered the most uncontroversial amendment, which inherently means, and this sounds weird, and it's kind of, you're right saying that. So it was never popular. There's never a fervor for it.
Oh, it's just something that kind of needed to be. Because I was looking at this thinking, like, this is probably the most tricky one because it's got the most words. Like, it looks like they had a really hard time, like, kind of simplify this one as much as, like, some of the other ones. Like, the right to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. Boom. Done. No, this one's got, quite a bit of stuff trying to cram it into one giant run-on sentence.
Should I try and read it as one giant run-on sentence?
Oh my God, is it one giant run-on sentence?
It is a giant run-on sentence.
I said that without reading it. I was like, man, I should probably double check that.
should we see if I can do it like the end of a end of a pharmaceutical commercial?
Can you do it in one breath?
Let's see. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a pursuit of indictment of a grand jury except causing an arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in a time of war and public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of the life and limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor deprived of life, liberty, or the property without due process, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
All right, let me give this a try. No person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment on a grand jury, except in cases arising in land or naval forces or in the militia when actual service time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. What happened?
You did it like the soft voice at the end of it. I love it. That's awesome.
Let's try to do it like the addendum, the last, like the thing you don't want people knowing. Oh, you still have like the, we'll have to do a video of people throwing a ball back and forth, like just distracting you from the actual words.
A husband and wife sitting in each other on bathtubs as the sun sets. So part of the reason this was so uncontroversial is that everything stayed in here was already generally accepted. Like, it was already part of common law.
Well, it's probably one of those, like, why do you have to write this down? Like, we got to know this.
That is how, there are some people who actually said that. Like, why do we have to have this written down?
You have to write down everything. You need to write this down.
Exactly. I mean, even the concept of the taking clause, which is that, you know, private property shall not be taken without just compensation. People were like, yeah, no crap. Why would you write that? Why'd you have to write that down? It's like
because Jackson's coming down the line here in a little bit, and like things are going to change.
it is an interesting, it does have an interesting history because it's so uncontroversial, and it really comes back to the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, which was written in 1641. Mm-hmm. So we tend to think of like revolutionary history as all one period. This was written the same distance between the Bill of Rights and World War I. As the Bill of Rights and the Massachusetts Body of Liberties. Remember,
this
Masters
is closer to this is closer to the Salem witch trials than the actual
this is
founding
like Salem
of the state.
Witch trials were yeah. going on.
Yeah, yeah.
When were the Salem?
I think they might have been right around then. Maybe a little bit before that.
They were 50 years afterwards.
Oh my god.
All right, so this is old, dude. Wild. This is yeah. old, man.
That's like a loss of Jamestown.
Yeah, yeah. So like this was, and Massachusetts was one of like the first, you know, the first non-just commercial colony in the United States. This idea of like a commercial colony is going to be focused on commerce, right? Where yeah. this is a new political body. And so Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Body of Liberties written in 1641, already outlined the vast majority of this in states. Every state subsequently, every colony subsequently just kind of adopted it. So yeah. by the time it made it to ratifying the Constitution, everybody's like, well, we already have this as state. And they're like, well, we're going to require the federal to follow these same laws.
Just in case, let's put this in here. This might come in handy later.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it.
Thank you, guys.
And as we close out, Kyle, I would like to harass you. I'd like to bother you on the Forgotten Amendment.
Okay, so I'm trying not to look at this one. So I'm going to set the stage here.
Yes. So there were 12 amendments in the Bill of Rights originally. And we're going to talk about the other one at the end of the next show. But one of the amendments is there was this concern that the House of Representatives was going to shrink mm-hmm. or it was going to stop growing as the nation gets bigger and bigger. And the House of Representatives is going to become this ultra concentrated body that really would function more like a Senate. And a lot of people had a fear of that, that you would not see part.
The House of Representatives?
Yeah.
Didn't we actually end up putting a cap on that? Like eventually?
We did in 1929.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. It's the thing we feared ended up better. Happening on purpose. Okay. All right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. You were right up the alley. You know where I'm going with this, sir. So what this amendment proposed was that there shall be no less than 100 representatives, nor less than one representative for every 40,000 persons. Until the number of representatives shall amount to 200, after which the proportion shall be so regulated by Congress that there shall be no less than 200 representatives, no more than one representative for every 50,000 people. And it's this idea that if you have one person representing 200,000 people, that means those 200,000 people have weaker votes.
Yeah. That makes sense. Because it's harder to get your guy's attention if he's got that many. It's just like going to school and having 30 desks per teacher versus 15, yeah. right?
It's like Wyoming. The strongest vote in America is somebody voting in Wyoming.
Right, yeah.
So it never gained popularity. Like mm-hmm. nobody just, I don't mean to sound mean, and I'm sure there's some historian who will correct me on this. People didn't care about this. Nobody cared.
Right.
It was like a very few people. So they tried to address fears like the House of Reps was not going to expand with population. Nobody even thought that was going to happen. I mean, the right. idea of people not wanting more votes and more politics, that's a natural thing to want.
Some of those numbers, too, they probably thought that was just insane to even think we'd ever get to that point, right?
Right, yeah. And even, maybe take that. So there was something called the Reapportionment Act of 1929, and that's what fixed the House of Reps to 435. Interesting. 1929, right? That's before we finished admitting all the states. So this survived new states being added. So,
yeah, that's true, yeah.
But, so, Kyle, if you or any of our dear listeners want to get together, this is still adoptable. It is still pending by states.
Oh, really?
So, any listeners want to get together and pass an amendment, you can call your House of Reps in the call your state house.
Called?
This is called the Congressional Appointment Amendment, and you probably think I'm joking. Another amendment was passed that exact same way.
Is that the one that we're going to be talking about next?
That is the one we're going to be talking about next time.
Well, I should have known we wouldn't be able to get through all 10 of these in one go. We'll be back soon with the rest of our deep dive into the Bill of Rights. But until then, leave us a comment, rating, or review on your platform of choice. Tell your friends about us or just send us a note of encouragement. BuckStartsHerePodcast.com is the website. Email is BuckStartsHerePodcast@gmail.com. The power is now in your hands. Produced by China Shop Productions.